Hello, Village. You're listening to Heal, Grow, Thrive, the podcast hosted by Forward Promise. If you don't know us, we're social change advocates focused on reclaiming the humanity of boys and young men of color and supporting the villages that nurture them. In our podcast, we'll talk with direct service practitioners, young people, researchers, and leaders in philanthropy, offering a deeper understanding of both the issues facing boys and young men of color and quality solutions for their healing, growing, and thriving. Thanks for joining us. You're listening to an important episode in our series, highlighting the voices of our grantees, fellows, and other stakeholders, and how they are pivoting their work in the face of this COVID-19 outbreak. We work with some phenomenal people who are fully committed to ensuring that boys and young men of color and their villages successfully emerge on the other side of this. This pandemic is exposing the disproportionate struggle faced by communities of color that is and always has been rooted in a history of dehumanization, racism, and colonization. These factors make boys and young men of color and their villages more vulnerable to illness, violence, and financial ruin. So we're dedicating these first episodes to sharing the issues and the solutions they've developed. We invite you to be thinking about, sharing, and doing what you can to ensure that boys and young men of color heal, grow, and thrive, both during this crisis and beyond.
So hi, everyone. I'm Rhonda Bryant, co-director of Forward Promise, a national program of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Like many of you, we are shifting all of our attention and focus these days to address the issues of the COVID-19 pandemic. Many of our grantees, our fellows, our national advisory committee members are thinking more about what their organizations can do meaningfully and in real time to meet the needs of some of our most marginalized communities who historically we know would be hardest hit by a virus of this type. And so we wanted to spend some time talking with those who are directly serving boys and young men of color and their families on a day-to-day basis to talk about how their work is being impacted and how they're responding, what are the greatest challenges, as well as our highest hopes for how we will come out on the other side in the midst of this. So joining me today is Hector Sanchez Flores. He's the executive director of the National Compadres Network, a Forward Promise grantee organization. Hector's work is leading the organization as it promotes methods that build upon the cultural and personal assets of people and communities, especially young men of color, to intervene and to prevent violence, truancy, teen pregnancy, and other life-limiting outcomes for children, teens, and their families. So thank you, Hector, for taking the time to be with us today and for sharing your immense knowledge and what National Compadres Network is doing in their different communities.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here and be part of this Forward Promise family that is trying to impact the lives of young people throughout this nation. So I'm very humbled to be here and offer what we're learning and what we're relearning as a result of this COVID-19 process.
Yes. So let's start with you just sharing with us, what is the impact that you're seeing right now in your community and with the various populations that National Compadres Network serves as you're responding to COVID-19?
So we have two sides to us, Rhonda, that I think are important to highlight. One of them is that work that we do directly with young men and who are already kind of, if you will, set aside in the margins a little bit. And what COVID-19 has done is it has coalesced our deeper understanding that we always understood that these young men were connected to somebody, right? And those somebodies, that family, that extended kinship network, sometimes is stronger and sometimes is a little bit more frayed. So we know that young men that were in school and really trying to push through with supports in the traditional sense, now all of a sudden, we're confronted with the lack of technology in home to be able to continue education, the lack of stability of internet that was different than, for example, just having a phone, that now there were different dimensions for them and they didn't know where to ask. They don't know, you know, is it even appropriate to ask, right? So our team, Ariel and Mario, we're really connecting with them and saying, these are the avenues that we can support you with. What else is needed? What we also came to know now from these same young men is that the people that they're attached to are in and of themselves functioning in an economy that is not the normal economy. Some of them may come from families that are mixed status, although some of them are US born. Some may have families that are not all US citizens. And as a result of that, all the things that we talk about that are supports for the people in the economy may not be afforded to these families and these individuals. So these young people are now realizing, what is it that I'm going to do to help my family at a time when we're all sheltering in place in California. So, the pressure of my family is different, and we're all sheltering in place does not afford them the same opportunities. The other part that came up was when you in the national climate that says immigrants are unwelcome because they're here to take advantage of the benefits that the federal government would offer. They say there's this narrative that if you take advantage of a public benefit, then it's going to hurt you if you ever apply for residency here. And so these families are now trying to figure out, well, would these benefits at some point in time be interpreted as a public benefit? And if so, does that jeopardize our whole family's ability to at some point apply for residency? Those were things, Rhonda, that didn't come to the forefront of my thinking, but are at the forefront of these young people and particularly their families, right? And as a person, as an organization that has staff that has DACA status, so as we're considering applying for resources, how does this person's benefit factor into that? We may be thinking, wow, we're just put him in the pool of the Paycheck Protection Program, not realizing that 6 months from now, 12 months from now, 24 months from now, they're going to say, well, you received a public benefit through this thing, and it shows that you're not here to contribute to society. I still don't know the right answer. And that's it. Now, that's, if you will, the economic level. Rhonda, the trauma that goes on when people who have experienced trauma in the community now have this second layer is how do they get the supports that they need? And we at NCN have really been pushing for círculos of support, circles of support. So we invite people that are working in a variety of sectors, including these young men, to share what's going on with them. In the hope that they feel connected to something positive, but also are allowed to release a little bit of the pressure valve that's going on. And we tend to cultivate these things on a personal level, like we're physically sitting together. So we didn't know how this virtual work might work. But I think given the circumstances, it's not the same, but it is beneficial. And people are sharing with us, I feel better from having the ability to share. The question then becomes is, as we get more relaxed conditions, how is it that we begin to ease it more back into the traditional way of doing this? And asking for support to do that is really crucial, right? I still am trying to figure out how it is that we structure a benefit for the young people so that it's not detrimental to the family, right?
Right.
So I don't know if that was helpful to you.
Oh, absolutely. That's something that has not come up in any of the conversations that I've heard yet about, thinking about what the impact of these benefits would be in the future for folks. And it's definitely something we need to put on the table to make sure that that does not become a hazard, for
Sure.
families later on.
Well, from my perspective, Rhonda, the way I'm looking at it is if there are additional resources that are afforded from, for example, philanthropy, how do I use those resources to support that, right? Because then it makes it cleaner for me, so not
Right.
jeopardizing. I mean, it's about resources, and I don't want to make it about resources, but it's about how the resources come in order to support this work moving forward.
Yeah. You talked a little bit about having to shift your Circulos work from being in person to being virtual. What are some other things that internally National Compadres Network has had to do in order to still do its work and function well
Sure.
in the community?
So when we saw this coming, we made sure that our staff had the equipment that they needed and this infrastructure they needed in order to do this. So we did some minor things, like everybody made sure they had computers that they can mobily take home. We provide an internet stipend because now they're using their personal internet for work purposes. So we afforded that. We have a telephone structure that allows people that if you call our telephone lines, we have the ability to answer it. And so we had on the phone, on a computer, on a variety of different platforms. So we were fortunate that we had that structure in place so that people could seamlessly do that. The part that we didn't factor in, Rhonda, was the fact that when you bring in people to do this work, there is a, if you will, a bias that I favor working interactively with you. It's wonderful to see you on video, Rhonda, but it's not the same as sitting with you at Haley Farm, right? And so all the people that choose to do this work, we favor that bias. 6 weeks in to sheltering in place, people don't even recognize why we're not feeling well. You know, what I'm doing my work, but it's not the same. And I have to remind people, it's because this is not what we signed up to do. This is not what we were, we're not built for this. If we were built for this, we wouldn't be doing this work, right? And so it's also dedicating time instead of going through staff, regular staff updates, deeper check-ins. How are you doing, right? And you know, the honesty is that, you know, some days are better than others, right? Some family are responsible for distance learning for little children in kindergarten. My son's in a senior in high school and my daughter's in eighth grade. They have the ability with some minimal support to manage it, but not all of us have that. So these are all these other factors and maintaining connections, right? Maintaining connections. So what we have done is that we try to have Zoom lunches with all the staff, no agenda, and we share an hour together. And it's when we fill in the gaps on our personal life. And so, you know, I look forward to, but what is it going to look on the way out? Will it be everybody in the office at the same time? Will it be half of the people? And, you know, we still don't know that, but I do know that people are doing this in their best way. The final thing that I would add is that our staff, some people have been affected by family members with COVID-19, right? And many of us, the vast majority of us, are, if you will, well from this. But nobody has been tested except one staff person. So we are operating with a confidence that I don't think is 100%, right? And so when I think about transitioning our work into the community, I don't just think about my staff. So I've been trying to get masks in case my team are asked to go out into the field to support the community. But the second part, Rhonda, is that I always think about is when we show up with full protection into the community and the community hasn't been afforded that same protection, what are we telling them? Like, oh, here we are, like, look at us, we're so protected. I think about this. I think about what would my father think? What would my mother think? And so there is a different layer of consideration when you're doing this work in the community. So like when I talked to a mask manufacturer, I said, we need it not just for my staff, we need it for the people we're gonna work with, because that's the only way we extend, we value your health as well, right? And I don't hear that being elevated yet, but I do think of the optics of those of us that have a privilege of doing this work the way we do it, that we don't project a privilege to a community of people we want to support in their journey of healing and saying, oh yeah, but bring your own masks, right? Well, how wonderful would it be to have a convening of 12 people, everybody has their packets, and on the packet, there's a mask for you, right? Saying, you know, this is a new reality. I think about that all the time, Rhonda. Of what people would think of us if we weren't that way.
Yeah. And it's something that I've never heard anybody say, and it is, I think, a testament to the heart that you and your entire team at National Compadres Network have for the work, and a way of valuing people and acknowledging their value, particularly when we know that in the communities, there's lesser access to all of these protective things. They can't find toilet paper and paper towels and Lysol and Clorox wipes in the stores to a greater extent than even folks that live in more affluent communities. And so I think the ability to provide some of these things as a part of your work is critical because of, acknowledging their humanity, like you've said, but then also just for the sheer fact that we all want to be healthy, and your economic status is not an indicator of how much you value your health.
No. And I'm just scratching the surface, right? We know that the unknown that is emerging to be known, what our Native American brothers are experiencing in some reservations, right? They're the infrastructure that is missing to support their health and journey. I was speaking to a brother in South Dakota, and he said all the hot spots that happened around the meat processing plants that are in South Dakota, he says they're affecting the Latino Mexican community there, right? He says, and now they're shifting the blame, like, well, they're all infected because they all live together in concentrated places, right? They're blaming the context. And he says, we live that way because that's the way we can survive best. COVID has just added a level of exposure that's harmful, right? But substitute any ethnic group, right? And we're going to see the emerging blame that goes with that group of people, right? And if we see one another as others, we're going to lose this in the long run, right? And we have to begin to kind of realize that I said that the supports in specific communities will overlap greatly, but they're not identical, right? And we have to become much more sophisticated in saying for these communities, these are the, we know we're going to need resources for families. We know we're going to need health supports in families. We're going to need employment supports. But for other communities, we're going to need immigration guidance, right? For other ones, we're going to need issues of gender, right? When you talk about LGBTQ. So there's going to be, if you will, a Venn diagram where we overlap greatly. But there's going to be really important segments outside that Venn diagram that are essential so that we can all move forward together, right? We can wax poetic on all the things that aren't happening the way I would want them to happen, but getting ready and staging for how we offer supports on healing and economic supports, health supports, what's the sequence? That's the question.
Because all of this is really shining a bright spotlight on the history of
Oh,
dehumanization
absolutely.
and trauma and racism and colonization that has been a part of our country for generations. And we're seeing all of this disparate impact, which is a direct result of the dehumanization that we have allowed to happen. I think now is the time for us to begin to lift up some very specific solutions to how we dismantle those things, because that's the only way that we're going to be able to move forward in a healthy and meaningful way. If you were to think about the community now, what are some of the structural things that you think need to be handled immediately for us to be able to move forward?
So I will say that obviously issues of testing, we need to know, and so I'm not going to belabor the point. If I receive a test that's offered by a local clinic, is that a public benefit? What are they going to take information from me and who's going to hold that and is that going to hurt me in the long run? We have to kind of say blanket, the health of our communities is crucial and we need everybody to be all in on this, right? And be very clear about it. The second part of it is, I had a conversation and I don't like citing personal conversations because it seems like, you know, this is maybe just an emblematic thing for me and not broadly. But what I did hear from this personal conversation was an older gentleman who said, I don't have to go back to Mexico, but I know people that were working in the day labor work that could not afford, because they had no money, they're returning back to Mexico. So the long-term effects of is like, what gaps are our communities gonna have? What are the impacts that in our communities we're gonna have? And how do we begin to create the structural supports so that people can stay at least where they were and begin to envision what that looks like, transformation, if they were whole and compensated for that work? I would say that the other part that we, you know, it's health, it's employment, and the spiritual dimension, right? Mm-hmm. Our grandmothers, our great-grandfathers, our ancestors survived through a spiritual dimension that they were connected with, right? And I'm not invested in which connection you have, but putting you in tune with that, I think, is critical for our work moving forward, because we can do a lot of things to build that transformation, addressing politics and policies and stuff like that. But one of the things that I feel that we need to make sure that we move space for is that reflective process that says, this is why I'm doing this work, right? I'm continuing the work of generations past. I'm holding space to keep it moving now. And I'm setting the stage so other people can build on this moving forward, right? You said it perfectly. This, we now know these things have been going on for hundreds of years. We are going to create a pathway to transform out of this, and it has to have a reflective dimension to it. Otherwise, I think we'll feel like we're getting progress, but the traumas will seep in, right? And we need to heal people, right? Traumatize people will traumatize people. So how do we move this forward in a way that we can all grow together, address the circumstances that we need, and move forward on another dimension? And I think philanthropy has a role in that, greater than, for example, public resources, because they have to say, we'll create a space and lane for that to be a part of the work moving forward. I think that's a critical part.
Yeah, agreed. So I want to ask you a more personal question.
Sure.
What have you learned about yourself during this time of the crisis?
You know, your imperfections come out much more, right? I love my family. You know, I have a wonderful wife who's supportive in everything we do. Lucy, a wonderful son, you know, who's worked really hard to position himself for his next step, and a wonderful daughter. But when we're all around, right, and you're stressed about making sure that payroll will be there for everybody, right, and that seeps into your personal space, I feel that our imperfections come out and are much more prevalent. I don't have an escape, really. I try to get out and I do my runs and that. But, you know, I'm humbled by that, right? I'm humbled by how I witnessed my father address adversity, right? And my mom and him working together. And I think he did it better than I did sometimes, right? And so I'm trying to realize that there's some teachings that my father left me that I had never needed to know, that right now are really crucial for me moving forward, right? I think about my mother, who was the person that orchestrated those things, and although she's safe and in good health, and I thank God for that every single day right now, I think about how these immigrants that came to this country not speaking the language, how they were able to really do things better. So what I have learned about myself is that there's some things that I'm prepared to do in my role as executive director. And I think I have to draw on some ancestral teaching sometimes to create a sense of peace and calm, not just in the work environment to the people that I care about and I work with, but also the people that I say that I love. And you've sat with me before and I say, what is it that we do that demonstrates the love that we have for the people that we say we love, right? And I think I have to activate that a little bit more. That's what I've learned about myself. And I feel, I don't know what my ancestors did, what sacrifices they created and made so that I could have the privileges that I enjoy right now. I do not take that for granted. That is what motivates me to be better, right? Because I know that their prayers and their sacrifices had a purpose, right? And I'm trying to make sure that I recognize and understand that so that I don't squander this opportunity so that we can come out of this with a better focus on how to impact our communities in a favorable way and create new levels of support. So, I didn't learn that at a university, right? And so where is it that I learned the levers to bring out what I need in order to support and work with the people that I work with and live with the people that I love, right? So that's what I've learned. I don't know if that's what you were looking for, but I'm humbled all the time. And I'm grateful and privileged.
No, I agree. And I think that's beautiful. I had a similar conversation with my mother about, just the struggles of her immigration experience and coming to the United States, and even just the struggles of that they faced growing up in the village in Trinidad, and how that compares to how people are navigating this experience right now. And she shared some really interesting and profound points with me around just being grateful, and just little things like the fact that we can still even go to the grocery store and get items. And those are things that we take for granted. And so I've been looking to gratitude more and more during this experience, and identifying the ways where, despite the difficulties that we're facing, both on the professional side, trying to keep the work going, and then also trying to keep our families going, that there are some privileges that we are afforded that allow us to navigate this better and differently. And I'm grateful for those things. And also at the same time, fighting to make sure that those who don't have those privileges have an opportunity to access them so that they can make it through on the other side of this as well. So.
I'll walk with anybody who's reflecting that way, Dr. Bryant. Anybody who's connected to those things I learned from as well. Your mother's teachings will reinforce those parts of my root that I know are intertwined down there, and strengthen us all. So, we're fortunate. We're part of that. We're part of that fortune. Doesn't mean we're perfect. But man, do I want things to be more fortunate for other people too.
Absolutely. Well, Hector, thank you so much for taking the time today to talk with me. It's always a pleasure. I always learn so much from our conversations, and I'm grateful for our friendship. So.
I esteem it deeply, Dr. Bryant. And I know I refer to you in the familiar, but I also want to make sure that gets put in too. Right, you had a little bit of a sacrifice to get that little precursor to your name, and so I want to acknowledge it. I also want to acknowledge the weight that you carry, right? It's not lost on me that as certain supports come to the grantees from the foundation, from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, those resources did not manifest magically in our labs. That there was a lot of work that was done to collect, organize, and present information so that additional resources and so we can say it happened magically, but even there's always a magician that makes it happen. So I want to acknowledge you and your team of people who organize that and work that. So muchas gracias de corazón.
You're welcome. You're welcome. And it's our hope that from getting these interviews out, that not only will Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, but many other folks in philanthropy as well, and also those who sit in positions of authority in some of our public systems, will learn some lessons about how they need to think about this current crisis so that our communities will benefit in the long run. That is the hope.
All our communities.
Take good care, brother, and we'll be in touch.
Igualmente, sister. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Heal, Grow, Thrive, the podcast. We hope these conversations prompt a deeper commitment to action in the field and in philanthropy to create a society that is fair and equitable for all. For more information about Forward Promise, visit forwardpromise.org or follow us on social media. We're simply Forward Promise on Facebook and @forward_promise on Twitter and Instagram.